My guest today, Dr. Cynthia Barnett, from her early days as a poor girl growing up on the Caribbean island of St. Vincent, has earned a PhD in her field. Her story is told in her book, I'm Not Done Yet, and You Shouldn't Be Either. She is a leading authority on how to refire and reinvent yourself, making your dreams come true. Along the way, Cynthia won the inaugural AARP Purpose Prize Award in 2017 and began a nonprofit organization called Amazing Girl Science. Now I'm talking to my followers, and I'm going to ask you, what was your dream? Did something happen to you along the way and you gave up on your dream? You just quit? Remember, you're never a failure until you quit. But if you persevere, ultimately you will succeed. Successful people have a burning desire to achieve their dreams. They acted in spite of their fears, and they tuned out the opinions of those who didn't encourage them. If you put your dream on a shelf, then you have no chance of it coming true until you pull your dream off that shelf and place it in your line of focus. Remarkable things happen when you decide what you want. You need to write out your heart's desires. Don't worry about whether you can afford it, if you know how to get it, or if you have other obstacles in the way. Just list what you want. Do you wake up every morning wondering what you were born to do and why you are here on this earth? Do you keep asking yourself, is this all there is? Do you feel an emptiness inside you that you haven't been able to fill? The secret to attaining a lifelong happiness is to learn to overcome rejection, expand your comfort zone, never give up, think for yourself, and follow your dreams. It really is the tough times that make us interesting and unique. Embrace those memories, draw strength from them, and learn to move on. It's not over until it's over. Cynthia, you have a great book. It's one of the best inspirational books that I have read, and I've read lots of them. I want you to start by telling our audience the blue uniform story. It shows a picture of you as a 12-year-old in a blue skirt and white blouse on the cover of your book. And this is so important to get started that I'd like to hear the blue uniform story, okay?
Okay, great, great. It's amazing that blue uniform has been the story that has carried me through my entire life. My mom came to the United States when I was about 11 or 12, and she came to the United States to seek a better life for her children. I grew up in a tiny island of St. Vincent, and we wore these blue uniforms to school, the blue skirt, like a royal blue type skirt, and a white shirt with like a little bow tie that was blue. And in the tropics, the sun just blazes down on color. And that color uniform turned white by the end of the summer. And my mom was a dressmaker. And she always made our clothes and made our new uniforms. But when she went to America, there was no one to make these uniforms. And we had to kind of wait for money to come from America to buy the fabric to have someone make the uniforms. And what happened was I kept, as the oldest of four, I have two other sisters who are younger than I was. I kept waiting for money to come from America. And there was no money coming. There was no letter coming. Finally, a letter came that said, my mom did not have the money to send because she had lost her job. And I was absolutely devastated. All I could think about was that other kids were going to laugh at us at school. And so we were poor and really get into that whole bullying type of thing. So the 2 days before school started, I was so depressed and upset about it. And I really didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell my sisters or even my grandmother. But I went to bed that night, and a light bulb went off in my head. Why don't you get up and look at that uniform again? So I got up, looked at it again, turned it back and forth, and finally I saw that the other side of the uniform was still bright blue because the sun had not penetrated. So I decided, okay, I am going to take the whole thing off. I'm going to take off the waistband. I'm going to take off the hem. And I am going to remake the uniform. I really didn't know how, but I had watched my mother sew, and we still had that old pedal machine. So I proceeded to take everything apart, and I proceeded to re-sew the uniform. And I ensure that every single, I'm sure it was all crooked. But the most important thing is that I remade my uniform, and I was so proud of it. Then I decided to remake my sister's uniform. And we went to school with bright new uniforms, and nobody knew that they were the same old uniforms, and they looked brand new. So that was the beginning of my journey of problem solving and figuring out that there's always possibility in things that I didn't have to give up. So that's my uniform story.
Yes, Cynthia. Did this story say something important about your self-esteem, and did it cause an attitude shift from accepting hard circumstances as inevitable to looking at them as if they were puzzles to be solved with creativity? And was this the time that you made an inner commitment never to give up on any challenge?
In retrospect, I think that was really the beginning of my whole attitude about never giving up, and that there's always hope, and that if I didn't give up, then I'd be able to solve whatever I needed to solve. At that specific time, I didn't really, as a 12-year-old, I didn't really think about it that way. My self-esteem and my confidence in myself was staggering. I couldn't believe that I actually did that. And it wasn't until many years later, as I've gone through my own journey, that I've realized what a great pivot that uniform story has been in my life. And brought me such, it really made me feel like I was invincible and that I really could do anything that I wanted to do.
Okay. Tell us the importance of your trip to America when you were 19 years old and the importance of your grandmother's nurturing you for the 7 years that preceded that. Your story tells about journeying to the land of the brave and how you decided that you would be brave and you would start practicing it then. You knew that America promised you great opportunity if only you had the fortitude to give back to it in hard work. You also saw America as an issue of trust. America trusted her people to accept the challenge of dreaming dreams, working hard to make those dreams come true, working side by side with people from around the world, and of respect. Our Constitution stated that our citizens respected God-given rights, and so the people should respect each other in speech, in religion, in taking care of their family as equals. The idea captured the spirit of the United States: reinvention, refinement, and renewal. And I was wondering what you meant by refinement, and what were some of the keys to embracing it?
Well, when I landed in America, you know, I still go back and remember those exact time when I landed in this country. Landed at Kennedy, and I came with really one dream. And that dream was that I was going to get the highest education this country had to offer. I had no idea how that was going to happen. And like I said, when I landed at Kennedy, I had never seen so many white people in my entire life, because my island was predominantly people that looked like me. And everybody was just racing around, and I was accustomed to a different type of lifestyle. But that did not deter me. I had this dream that I was going to, education was going to be a big factor for me. And when my mom was a dressmaker, she had no idea about college. And I had to figure out how this was all going to happen. No idea, had not much money. And it was like a dream in the sky, but it was my dream. And so what happened was I applied to different colleges and got a lot of rejection. And the rejection came because I did not have an American high school diploma. I graduated my own high school when I was 16. And I didn't have an American diploma. I had not gone to American high school. And they suggested I go back to high school and get an American. I decided, no, that was not going to happen. So what happened was that even as much as the fact we didn't have much money growing up, my family believed in extracurricular activities. And one of the things that was very inexpensive was piano lessons. And I took piano lessons ever since I was like 7 or 8 years old. And somebody said to me, gee, you play piano, why don't you apply for music schools? I said, oh, no, I don't want to go to music school, because I really didn't want to teach music. I was pretty good at playing the piano because I was very good at practicing. So I took the audition. I found out where there was a music school. I took an audition. And the first time I took the audition, I did not pass that audition. But in my whole never giving up attitude, I said to the judges, I said, well, what can I do? What can I do to pass this audition? So they suggested, well, you hire a teacher, because I had been in this country for over 6 months without a teacher at that time. Hire a teacher and then come back. And I asked them for recommendations. So I hired a teacher and I practiced 4 or 5 hours a day. I went back to the audition, and this time they accepted me. So that's how I started my college education. And should I go on?
Well, I just wanted to say that you and I have so much in common. I didn't graduate from high school either. I went to college when I was 16, and I was a junior in high school. And that just struck me. It was the first time that I'd heard that part of your story and everything like that. But I would say that you wanting to be a master at piano, and the fact that you would, well past midnight, play the same songs, repeating each measure until your fingers instinctively and automatically knew where to go reminds me of a story of one of my mentors and one of my radio talk show guests, and his name was Les Brown. And he is such a dynamic public speaker that I wanted to be like Les Brown. So when I got the chance to interview him, I said, Les, you're such a great platform speaker. You don't stand behind the lectern. You walk all over the stage. You don't use cards to remember where you're at. You don't have a teleprompter. What's your advice so that I can be as good a public speaker as you are? And he said, Wynn, well, I'll tell you. When I gave my first speech, I was lousy. I was scared. But by the time that I'd done 10 speeches, I got over some of that anxiety by just doing it. And when I did my speech the 100th time, I was getting much better. And by the time that I'd done that speech 1,000 times, I could do what I'm doing now, which is connect with my audience without cards, without a teleprompter, and that's what I would tell you to do. Whatever it is that you want to do, do it 1,000 times. By that time, you'll be an expert at that. And you said that with your constant practice of practicing up to 5 hours every day, that you had grown past just enjoying the music. You had grown to love it and be passionate about it. And that's what I got out of your story about the piano, is do it until you're the best at it that you can be, and you're the most passionate about whatever it is that you can be. Does that kind of fit with how you were feeling?
Absolutely, absolutely. Should I continue on with that story?
You want to tell more about your piano story?
Yes.
Go ahead.
So after the I got into the music school, and the plan was that I was going to be a music educator. That means teach kids music. That did really appeal to me because I love variety. I didn't just want to teach music. And unfortunately, the college went bankrupt after 2 years. But the college administrators were smart enough to, they made a deal with New York NYU that NYU would take over all the students in their music department. And that is how I ended up graduating from NYU. And as soon as I got to NYU, I switched my major to elementary education, where I had all the variety that I wanted. So it's like one door closes, another opens. And NYU was one of the schools that rejected me in the earlier days when I applied.
It's amazing.
Or one just never knows.
Yeah, it's amazing, Cynthia, that if you follow your dream that you're passionate about, that will happen to you more often than not. So it gets back to one of the truths that you and I have about persistence.
Mm-hmm.
Persistence is the major thing we're talking about here, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit more about that later. But I want to move on to the story of you learning to drive at age 22, when most people learn to drive when they're 16 or 15.
Yes.
And how it taught you that you could do anything if you persevered at it. You said, no matter what happens, I'll never, ever give up. And Calvin Coolidge, one of our presidents, said, nothing in the world can take the place of persistence. Talent will not. Nothing is more common than unsuccessful men and women with talent. Genius will not. unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education alone will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistence and determination alone are omnipotent. Tell us that story of learning to drive. And
well, I lived in the Bronx in New York for over 10 years. And I didn't have to learn to drive because public transportation was everywhere. Then I moved to Norwalk, Connecticut, and I could not drive a car. Plus, where I lived, there were no public transportation. So I had no choice but to learn how to drive. I was so scared of driving. And here I was about 29. When I had to learn how to drive. I remember I hired an instructor who, his advertisement was for nervous drivers. And that's the reason I hired him, because it said nervous drivers. But I never forget the day I got behind the wheel and he made me sit behind the wheel and I just prayed. I said, "Do you have the brakes on?" I was just so scared. He said, "Oh, yes, I have brakes on my side." My hands were dripping wet. My heart was pounding. Oh, my goodness, that was some experience. Eventually, I learned how to drive. And the car that we owned at the time was a standard shift. So not only did I have to learn to drive automatic, I had to learn how to drive the standard shift. And I'm telling you, every 5 or 6 minutes, I was stalling because I would forget to move the shift. And the time came when I became more and more comfortable driving. I still don't drive on the highway. I still am scared of driving on the highway. So I drive around my local roads, and I'm pretty comfortable. But driving is still not something that I enjoy. And because of that, I made all my children, 16 and 18, learn how to drive so that they wouldn't have that nervous feeling that I had for so many years and still have some of that nervousness.
But the But the important part of this story, I think, is that you decided that regardless of what happened, you would never give up until you were successful at driving.
Absolutely, but really, I didn't have a choice. If I had a choice, I don't think I would have done it. But I had no choice, and I just had to do it.
Right. Now, the next story that I want to talk to you about is in your book, and so since it's in your book, I guess it is fair game to talk to you about it, but I know it might be personally hard to talk about it, perhaps, but you told the story of your deteriorating marriage and said your low self-esteem did not help this. You were 60 pounds overweight, and you desperately wanted to believe your husband loved your heart and your weight didn't matter to him, but it bothered you. You hid behind a smile when you were out in public doing all you knew to convince others to remember your optimistic personality and forget your obvious lack of self-control when it came to food. You struggled between feeling ugly on the outside and wanting desperately to be thought of as beautiful on the inside. This food addiction led to your divorce. Your low self-esteem said that you didn't care what kind of marriage you had, that any kind of marriage was still a marriage, and you desperately wanted to keep it because you were terrified of raising 3 children by yourself. One of the significant issues was that you have been rejected, and in this case, rejected in favor of someone else, someone who was thin, who told you she was your friend. You were devastated by unbearable shame and you were terribly angry. Now, you joined a support group and finally attended with new fervor. You made a commitment to stick to the plan, choose healthy foods to eat, and with God's help, lose weight. This problem turned around for you to signify your success when you finally realized that you are a person of value. Your divorce stood out in your mind, and it was one of the most difficult times of your life. During your marriage, you were overweight, you had low self-esteem, and you became completely dependent on someone else for your emotional well-being. After the divorce, you decided that you did not want to give up. You could not give up. And in the end, you came to realize the innate power of perseverance, something which is in all of us, something that affects our very survival. You came to realize the value of persistence and prayer. In your mind, you remembered Gloria Gaynor's song, "I Will Survive," and that phrase and that title became your daily theme and constant anchor. You said that not only did the divorce mark the end of your marriage, but the end of a decade of depending on someone who was undependable. You realized that you were codependent and an enabler, enabling your husband to continue not to work after 2 full years of unemployment. And when your husband had gone and you were left to make your own decisions, you discovered you had the inner strength that you never knew you had. And so my questions are, what did that do for your self-esteem? Thinking back to your earlier years, you used the skills you learned at age 12, creativity and problem solving. So kind of tell our audience some of the things that I may have not covered and your thoughts about that divorce.
Well, I've got to say that that divorce was the beginning of discovering who I am, who I truly am, and how strong I am as a person. And discovered much, much later on that it had nothing to do with weight. The weight was all in my mind. Regardless of what the weight would have been, he's now deceased. My deceased husband would have left anyway because the grass always looked greener on the other side for him. At the time of the divorce, my self-esteem was on the ground. I really wanted that marriage to last. I had dreams of an intact family with a picket fence because I did not grow up with an intact family. My father left the island of St. Vincent when I was about 5, and I never saw him again until I was like maybe 29 or 30. But I wanted for my children, I wanted a mother and father. And that divorce just broke. It was the dissolving of a dream that I wanted. And at that time, I would have taken anything. I would have taken the crumbs that he offered just to keep it together. But it was not meant to happen that way. And the fact that he wanted out, even though I begged to stay, I wanted counseling and everything. I wanted to do anything to keep the whole family together. And then, my daughters were young. They were like 11, 5, and 3, and I did not want to be left alone to raise 3 daughters of my own. So when he left, I can't tell you how devastating it was. But I decided that I had to make a decision. Either I was going to drown or I was going to swim. I decided I was going to swim. And so many things happened. The year he left, the roof of my house went. My septic tank went. And I had to figure out I had to figure out and problem solve how I was going to fix it all. And it was there again, my problem solving skills came in, my creativity came in. I figured out how I can have second jobs. Like, I'm very good at art, so I started teaching macrame. I started teaching arts and crafts. And that was like my second job to make ends meet. And to close my daughters, I found every consignment shop in the area. So my kids always looked good going to wherever they had to go. And like I said, my creativity and problem solving when I was 12 years old, turning that uniform inside out, all kicked in. And I found a strength that I had no idea that existed. Then I became, you know, my confidence increased. And my daughters are now 52, 47, and 44. And my one big goal for them was to bring them up to be independent women. And they've all, to make sure they all had a college education, which is important to me. So I brought them up when they were growing up to be responsible, and they all ended up in their first year of college getting quite a few scholarships. And then I figured out how to end up paying for the rest of their education. So my oldest daughter is a lawyer by trade. My second daughter is a freelance designer. And my third daughter is a principal. So they're all very professional women. And that was my dream for them. And that all came out of the fact that I never gave up. I kept the focus in mind of bringing them up to be responsible women. And at the same time, continuing to grow as a person. And the journey has been great. And I noticed that you're also interested in Og Mandino. He is one of my favorite people.
Yes.
And
Og.
I did a lot of personal development. Og Mandino is one of them. Jack Canfield, I continued with my own personal growth. And today I'm just living a life beyond my own wildest dreams.
Yes. Og is or was a personal friend of mine, and He wrote.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he wrote a book about. All his books were inspirational, but one of them, he put the 17 things that he would recommend that you do, and he gave me permission to change those into affirmations, and I put them in one or more of my books, and so if you go to my website, or if you go to my podcast, you can look up Og Mandino, and I guarantee you it will be worth the time that you spend finding out about the 17 things that he thought that you ought to do in life.
Wow. And my greatest book with Og Mandino is The Greatest Salesman.
Yeah, that was a great book. He read, I think, at least 7 books.
Yes.
He was an inspiration to me. I've written 44 books, and so I guess I got something out of what he had to say.
Yes.
Okay, so I wanted to also say that you talked about being artistic, and to me that's very important. Because in my treatment program for 30 different addictive behaviors, one of the primary things that you need to do is to be creative. And
yes.
It could be anything. You could be creative in anything, but you need to be creative because it builds your self-esteem and keeps you from going down a rabbit hole of depression and other things. And back in 1980, I became an artist. And I have a story, but it's too long to tell, of how that happened. And since 1980, there's hardly ever a day that's gone by that I didn't create something artistically. And I can tell you, if you are being creative every day, there's not a whole lot of chance of getting depressed and having a low self-esteem. So I just bring that up because you said you were an artist, and I've been an artist for many, many, many years. Now, I'd like to move on to unfair things that happened to you in your life. And I want to say that one of the truths of the matter is life. And so when we talk about this unfairness, I will just say that it just reiterates that fact. Now, one of the unfair incidents in your life was when you got turned down as a high school administrator, and that was the position you wanted. It didn't make any sense to you. You had the necessary credentials plus the required experience. However, the position went to a man with credentials far inferior to yours, a white man. You had a feeling of being betrayed. It was so crystal clear a case of discrimination that you decided to fight it legally. And although you were victorious, this was 1992, and it did not get rid of the prejudice of society. You could not understand why anyone should be treated differently simply because of the color of their skin. But when you went back to work and prayed, "God, you walk in front of me and I will walk behind you," you found that it was difficult to do that. During that time, you found a book that was important to you and read it, and it was Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And what I want to ask you in talking about this part of your story is, why was that so important? You said, with strong spiritual foundation and putting God in the driver's seat, a person could do anything. And in the end, your seasoned perseverance and well-developed problem-solving skill combined with God's strength got you through another difficult time in your life. Would you like to comment?
Oh, absolutely. That was a big turning point for me. It really helped me to become even more spiritually connected. It was a position where I was not wanted. And because I fought it legally, I was able to get the job. So when I walked into the building, the principal just handed me a list of duties, some of which he had taken away from other assistant principals who had more experience. Basically, he set me up to fail. But I was determined that I was not going to fail because God is all-powerful, and I totally believe that it was not going to happen. Like you mentioned, I did read Dale Carnegie's book. Also, what I did was I went to that same principal who did not want me. As a matter of fact, most of the secretaries and most of the people there thought I was militant because I fought for something that I felt that I deserved and worked for. So I went to that same principal every few weeks and I said, "Well, how am I doing? Is there anything that I need to address that I have not seen or don't know about?" And he would tell me what the things were, and I documented those conversations for 5 years. So as a result of that, I never got a bad evaluation because he could not give me a bad evaluation because I kept going to him and asked him how I was doing. So, but I had a secretary that really watched my back and all the other support staff that really helped me. So they were so instrumental in helping me, making sure I was not going to fail. And every morning when I went into work, the first thing I did was turn on classical music, did my prayer, and asked God to guide me through the day. And I ended up having, I ended up staying at that school for 10 years before I actually retired. And it was the best experience for me, and it made me much more spiritual, trusting and having faith.
Okay. I next read in your book about the time that you got a C in school. And I wanted to tell you how my school experience was similar to yours. When I went to college, my first class was in basic English. And I got a C in that class, even though the teacher understood that I needed A's to get into medical school. But for whatever reason, she gave me a C. And I took that as a lesson in perseverance. Mm-hmm. Like you, I said, I'm never going to make a C again. Mm. And at the end, now she's dead, and she gave me a C in basic English, and I have published 44 books, and she never published one.
Mm.
So I'm thinking, if you rely too much on what other people say about you, you're barking up the wrong tree. Do you agree?
That's right. Absolutely.
Okay. Now, the next story is, when your last daughter left home, a restlessness appeared. You felt unfulfilled. You said, who am I now? You came to realize that you still wanted and needed to utilize your skills and abilities in a meaningful way. Your work had become a daily job instead of a meaningful career, and you became increasingly disenchanted. You ask, what now? What now? What now? And I'd like for you to tell us about your life-changing dream that was different from all your other dreams. And tell us about your transition from an assistant principal at a high school to your academy, and how it was meant to make a great impact on the lives of others beyond your immediate circle. And tell us about your gray-haired friends and how you encouraged them to follow their passions that had been there all along, and to let them know that unquestionably now was the time to make a difference. Tell us about the STEAM program, the Amazing Girl program. How did you feel when you knew that you had made a difference in the world? What did it mean for you to receive the inaugural AARP Purpose Prize? You said the plaque on the wall symbolized the true reward you experienced, the fulfillment that comes from giving wholeheartedly to others.
You know, it's amazing that when I left my position as an assistant high school principal, I had been in the school system for over 30 years. But I just knew in my bones that God had something else in mind for me. And I had no idea what it was. And I told my colleagues that I was going to refire my life. I was not going to retire, because I do not believe in the word retirement. And one day, like you mentioned before, my last daughter had left for college, and I was really getting really depressed and feeling unfulfilled. And then I read an article that said women are not going into the sciences. Well, a light bulb went off in my head that I could join that movement to help close that gender gap. So I founded a program called Amazing Girls Science. And when I first started the program, I really didn't know how far it was going to go or what was going to happen. I collaborated with the local community college, and I invited girls to just come and have a great day of fun, hands-on science. Well, I was looking for about 50 girls, but 100 girls showed up. Well, the rest is history. Since that program, we have impacted the lives of over 500 girls a year through science conferences, robotic programs, girls who code, cryptography, all those other names that I didn't even know about, that I am a researcher, so I found out what girls needed. And that program has just been the most fulfilling thing I've ever done. I have learned more in this part of my life than I've learned in the other half as being in the school system. The girls are from first grade all the way up to high school. And so that was really a dream that I didn't know that was going to happen. But it's a dream that I stepped through because it was answering my calling. For me, it's a great opportunity to give back to the community. I've gotten so much, and I just love giving back. I love seeing the excitement of these girls when they're doing their projects. And one of the most validating experiences winning the AARP Purpose Prize Award. There were like 700 people nominated for this award. And I was one of five that was given this award. This was really a very prestigious award that came with money. And the money that I got, I invested it back into the program so that I can give girls more scholarships. All my programs are very inexpensive, but there are many girls who can't afford it. So I continue to use that money to encourage girls to go into science and give them an opportunity. To me, it's all about giving girls an opportunity. They may not be scientists, but they've gotten an opportunity to develop their own self-esteem, to develop self-confidence, that they could do things, that they don't have to wait for the boys to do programming, that they could program, and that they could have the possibility of a career that's so important in the 21st century, with computers and learning how to code. So it's been a very fulfilling and rewarding experience for me. And it does require quite a bit of work, but for me, it's not work. I totally enjoy doing it. So that's the journey. So I became an entrepreneur without realizing I'm an entrepreneur. So it's been quite an adventure, and I just love every moment of it. I could do this for the rest of my life.
And you probably will. Cynthia.
Yes. And in the meantime, my friends, I encourage them to not just to do things to keep busy, but to do things with a purpose in mind, to find out what their own calling is and whatever their purpose is, to go after it purposefully. And that is what brings the joy and fulfillment and happiness.
Well, you talked about don't retire, refire. And you didn't want to be one of those people who stopped working only to die within months of their retirement party. I found out some years ago that the highest time for a man to commit suicide is the year he retires.
Yes.
And I ask myself, why is that? And it gets down to the basic thing that I talk about in my program of addiction is that you have to have a good self-esteem in order not to be addicted to things. And if your self-esteem was related to your job and you don't have that job any longer, self-esteem goes down to the floor, and you say, why should I still live? I don't have anything to make me feel good about myself anymore. And that's because the people's jobs were their purpose, and now they don't have a purpose. And you want to inspire people to always have a purpose. And so as things change in life, sometimes your purpose changes, and that's fine. It's not what purpose you have, but it's important that you have a purpose, right?
Absolutely.
You said, looking back, sometimes dreams must be put on hold for a while, and that's okay. But it is not okay to give up on your dreams. That is never okay. And your advice to dreamers, work hard and never, ever give up on your dreams. The thing that I remember is that persistence is one of the truths of life. It makes the difference between success and failure, and we'll get to that probably in a little bit. But you learned that, and now that you've written about it in your book that anybody can buy, that can teach them a very important truth, and that's the truth of success related to persistence. Where can our listeners get a copy of your book?
They can go to Amazon.com and just Google I'm Not Done Yet by Dr. Cynthia Barnett.
Right. Okay. The next point, the things you've learned that you really want us to know. I rarely did it all alone. I often had help. I never gave up. Sometimes my obstacles were of my own making, and sometimes others put obstacles in my way. But either way, I discovered that creativity, persistency, and help from others when needed are the keys to overcoming all of life's challenges. If we overcome life's obstacles and squarely face life's challenges, we are free to live our dreams. Be inspired, you said. Be refired. Your comments?
Those words are absolutely perfect, and that is exactly how I feel. When we live that way, with the attitude of never giving up, using all the God-given gifts that we've been given, we will refire our lives, especially in this second half, which is really important to not just sit back and be in the rocking chair and just waiting to die. I say it's time to refire and not retire, because we are never done yet.
How true. And that takes care of most of the important points that you've written about in your book, and I would recommend everybody to get a copy of it, and I challenge you to read it without getting emotionally involved, because I'm sure you will. Now, in the back of your book, you put some quotes that are important, and I would like to start by an affirmation that I make every day or multiple times during the day, and I've had this affirmation for a long while, and I think that you will understand how it speaks to both the way I feel about things and how about the way you feel about things. And here it is. I am the one. This is the place. Now is the time. His hand is upon me. And I'm not even close to being done yet. So that's what I've been saying for a long, long time. And it seems to be something that keeps me going. Now, here are some other ones that you put in your book. And if you want to comment after I read them, it would be my clip. Pleasure to hear what you have to say. One of my mentors, Marianne Williamson, said, Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us.
That's a very powerful from Marianne Williamson. The first time I heard that was when Mandela said that. And I thought he had written it, then found out much later on it was dropped by Marianne Williamson, that we're all born with this light. And sometimes we put that light under shadow because we don't want other people to think that we're powerful. But it's just so important to shine that light so that other people will be encouraged to shine their light. So that's all. That's what I've gotten. This is a much longer poem. This is a very short part of it. And I would encourage the readers to find out, to read the whole thing. It's about 3 or 4 different paragraphs. And it's really worth the reading.
Nelson Mandela talks about and was able to do one of the things that you did, and he did it for a long time, which is to take a situation that was unfair, have a good attitude, live through it, and come back and refire. And
yes.
I'm sure that it, if you've seen the movie or if you've read from him, these are some things that would be very important in any of us to be able to get the most out of our life that we can. The next thing is, John Addison wrote, "I will do today what others don't, so I will have tomorrow what others won't."
Hmm.
Yeah, if you're willing to do what other people won't do, you'll have what they won't get. It's
absolutely. And in fact, research shows that 99% of people don't live up to their potential. They are very happy not to do too much. And so they never achieve all the things that they were destined to achieve.
My next quote is from Venus Williams, the tennis star. "You have to believe in yourself when no one else does. That's what makes you a winner."
Hmm. That is so true. You just have to have your own confidence. Just can't wait for somebody to say, be good, and you're good at this and that. It's great for people to make those compliments, but it's more important that you believe in your own self.
The next one is from an artist that I can really relate to, Pablo Picasso. He said,
"Oh yes,
only put off for tomorrow what you are willing to die left undone."
That really is profound, because, you know, we tend to procrastinate so much. And tomorrow may never come. And Pablo Picasso is one of my favorite people. I saw a lot of his works when I went to Spain on one of my travels.
An example of that was that I went to church and heard a revivalist preacher, and he told of, during one of his messages at the end, he invited people to come down and start believing in Jesus and make a decision that would guarantee their eternal ability to be with God. And there was a 17-year-old high school girl. And she said, "You know, I really want to do that, but not tonight. I'll come back on Friday and do that." And on Thursday, on the way to school, she drove off the road, hit a tree, and died.
Mm.
And I was thinking, what a tragedy.
Yes.
You don't have tomorrow.
No.
You only have right today. And any important decision that you're going to make in your life, make it now.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I learned from that.
Yes. I totally, totally believe in that. All we have is now. Tomorrow is not promised. Right. Don't put it off.
Thomas Edison said, if we did all the things we are capable of doing, we would literally astound ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think he spent years trying to develop a light bulb and came up with 1,000 or 10,000, I don't know how many, things that didn't work. But he didn't see it as a failure. He saw it as getting one step closer to being successful. And what if he had quit? You know, maybe we wouldn't have bulbs today. I don't know. Michelangelo said...
Wait. Yes, go ahead. Sorry.
Michelangelo said, the greatest danger for most of us is not that our aim is too high. And we miss it, but that it is too low and we reach it. Isn't that something that is totally true?
Absolutely.
Albert Einstein said, there are two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing was a miracle. The other is as though everything is a miracle.
That's such a beautiful saying, because everything is a miracle. We look outside. We're able to have eyes to look outside, see the sky, see the trees. They're all miracles. It's a miracle that we're here right now.
Absolutely. One of the people on my radio talk show, Ken Blanchard, wrote a bunch of books having to do with business, and they were a story that gave the person a certain insight in things that would help them in their business. He said, the difference between interest and commitment is that when you're interested in doing something, you do it only when it's convenient. And when you are committed to something, you do it and you accept no excuses, only results.
That's beautiful.
Andrew Carnegie said, if you want to be happy, set a goal that commands your thoughts, liberates your energy, and inspires your hopes. I'm sure that you were doing that all through your career in life.
Yes.
Some people talk about passion. Be passionate about what you're doing. And be passionate and persistent, and you will get where you're going. Oliver Wendell Holmes, the Chief Justice, said, many people die with their music still in them. Too often, it's because they are always getting ready to live before the time runs out. And that goes back to do it today. You may not have tomorrow. W. Clement Stone said, and I'm sure that this is something that you did also, tell everybody what you want to do, and someone will want to help you.
Absolutely true.
You found that to be true in some of the stories?
Oh, absolutely, especially in my nonprofit organization. People just step up to help. They say, how can I help you? Some of them just send a donation to help with the program. It's just amazing.
Right. Oprah Winfrey said, be thankful for what you have and you'll end up having more. If you concentrate on what you don't have, you will never, ever have enough. I think we have so much stuff to be grateful for that when we wake up each morning, we ought to list all the things that we're grateful for before we start our day. And you'll find that it makes a terrific difference in how your day goes.
But when we are grateful, we have no time to be sad. We have no time to be depressed. Being grateful doesn't have to be like climbing Mount Everest. It's very simple. We're able to get up and walk. That's being grateful. We're able to open our eyes and see. That's grateful. So, you know, being grateful is one of the things that I practice every day, and I believe everybody should practice gratitude every day.
Absolutely. And my last quote from your book, Martin Luther King Jr. said, "Change is not rolling on the wheels of inevitability, but comes through continuous struggle."
Oh, true.
Well, Cynthia, that takes us through your book. It's a great book. It's one of the best books that I've read as an inspirational and motivational books. I think everybody should get a copy of it. But going back and touching the high point, can you tell us some secrets that people who go on to achieve big dreams have that any of us listening today can use?
Well, they never give up. They're consistent. They keep the dream in front of them all the time. Sometimes some of them have it written. But the whole idea is that you never give up. You just keep your eyes on the prize. And it will happen. It may not happen exactly when you think it's going to happen, but it will happen. There's no question about it. Persistence, perseverance, and never giving up.
Absolutely. And you've made a great contribution to the world from your book. Some of these ideas that we focused on makes all the difference in your life experience. And so I honor you and applaud you for the sacrifices that you've made and for the ability to bring them into perspective that other people can learn from. So thank you again for everything that you've done.
And thank you so much for the opportunity to share.